From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The past few days of Hurricane Ida and the wildfires in the West and the unprecedented flash floods in New York and New Jersey is yet another reminder that these extreme storms and the climate crisis are here. We need to be much better prepared. We need to act.
As the death toll climbs from flash floods in the Northeast, President Biden heads to the Gulf Coast, where Hurricane Ida first made landfall Sunday. We'll go to New Orleans, which is still without power in the sweltering heat, to speak with Malik Rahim, who helped found the mutual aid group Common Ground after Hurricane Katrina. He continues to help feed people in need. As the city swarms with police, he says help from the federal government is hard to find. Then, as we move into Labor Day weekend, we look at dirty work, essential jobs, and the hidden toll of inequality in America with New Yorker writer Ale Press.
Just to kind of get at what I mean by dirty work and why it is actually similar to the essential worker conversation in some ways. These are jobs that support the prevailing social order that we have.
We'll speak with some of the people profiled in dirty work, including Christopher Aaron, a former military intelligence analyst for the CIA's drone program, and Dulce Castaneda, with Children of Smithfield, led by family members of meatpacking workers.
COVID really exacerbated the alarmingly dangerous working conditions that many meatpacking workers were already working in prior to COVID-19, including repetitive motions, causing stress on the body, hand and shoulder injuries, and in addition to, you know, workers often having too little time to sanitize and use the restroom or change their equipment.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Mimi Goodman. The death toll from unprecedented flooding in the northeastern U.S. has risen to 46 after the remnants of Hurricane Ida left a trail of destruction from Pennsylvania to Massachusetts. Much of Philadelphia's Vine Street Expressway completely flooded, resembling a canal running through the city center. Here in New York, the bodies of at least 11 people were found in flooded basement apartments. A growing number of poor and working-class people, many of them immigrants, have been forced into illegal basement dwellings due to a shortage of affordable housing. Meanwhile, Mayor Bill de Blasio joined Governor Kathy Hochul and Senator Chuck Schumer Thursday in demanding Congress pass a federal infrastructure bill to help cities prepare for the climate catastrophe.
What we've got to recognize is the suddenness, the brutality of storms now. It is different. A record set 2 weeks ago, another record set now, rainfall like we haven't seen ever before. This is the biggest wake-up call we could possibly get.
Meanwhile, Hurricane Ida's death toll along the Gulf Coast has risen to 16. More than 830,000 customers remain without power. Louisiana officials say critical shortages of fuel are hampering relief efforts. State and federal officials are investigating reports of oil and chemical spills along the Gulf Coast in the wake of Hurricane Ida. The investigations come after the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, that's NOAA, published aerial photos showing miles of oil slicks along the Mississippi River and in the Gulf of Mexico, including spills near a Phillips 66 refinery and an Enterprise offshore drilling platform. In Afghanistan, humanitarian flights by the United Nations have resumed in parts of the country. The World Food Program warned the current political upheaval has only compounded the food insecurity brought on by years of conflict and a devastating drought. Some 14 million people, or one-third of the population, face acute food insecurity, and half of all children under age 5 suffer from malnutrition. Western Union announced Thursday it's resuming money transfer services to Afghanistan. In the western city of Herat, dozens of women took to the streets Thursday to demand the Taliban respect their human rights and full participation in Afghan society.
We demand the right of education, employment, freedom, security, and also presence in public forums, social activities, politics. We have to take place in political, social, and public fields. We have fought for these important rights for years.
Meanwhile, intensifying fighting between rebel Afghan forces and the Taliban in Panjshir province, located north of Kabul, has reportedly resulted in casualties on both sides. This comes as the Taliban is poised to announce the formation of a new government in Kabul, with Reuters reporting recently returned Taliban co-founder Mullah Baradar will be its leader. Japanese Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga said Friday he will not seek re-election and will resign September 30th, less than a year after he took office. Suga has faced widespread criticism over his mishandling of Japan's coronavirus response and for pushing ahead with the Olympic and Paralympic Games despite surging COVID-19 numbers. Japan continues to report about 20,000 daily cases, and its overburdened hospitals are turning away thousands of patients each day. In the United States, COVID-19 deaths are continuing to rise rapidly, with nearly 3,000 deaths reported on Thursday. In Florida, which recorded a pandemic-high death toll in August, hospitals report more than 90% of all ICU beds are occupied, with significant shortages of oxygen. Meanwhile, NBC News reports at least 15 million COVID-19 vaccine doses across the U.S. have gone to waste, representing about 3% of all doses delivered. Democrats say they're preparing to fight against Texas's new law essentially banning abortions after the Supreme Court refused to halt it. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said the House will hold a vote this month on the Women's Health Protection Act, which could help protect abortion rights. But the legislation is unlikely to receive a 60-vote filibuster-proof majority in the evenly divided Senate. President Biden slammed the unconstitutional chaos unleashed by the Texas abortion ban, vowing to deploy a, quote, whole-of-government effort to respond to the attack on Roe v. Wade. Meanwhile, in Texas, abortion providers say they're having to turn away distraught patients, many of whom will now have to leave the state if they can afford it in order to access abortions. Pandemic-related unemployment benefits are set to expire this Labor Day weekend for millions of people across the U.S., even as many states endure their worst outbreaks of the pandemic. About 3.3 million people who've exhausted state unemployment assistance will lose their pandemic emergency benefits. Also expiring is a program that provided aid to about 4.2 million jobless gig economy and self-employed workers. Nearly 3 million unemployed people will lose an extra $300 weekly benefit. The cutoff comes after the Biden administration repeatedly declined to ask the Democratic-controlled Congress to extend unemployment benefits. West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin called on fellow Democrats Thursday to pause plans for the $3.5 trillion spending bill, citing the bill's price tag and the risk of inflation. The measure would create millions of well-paid union jobs and a civilian climate corps to combat the climate crisis. It would also expand Medicare, extend the child tax credit, and would provide funds for universal pre-K and tuition-free community college. The bill is unlikely to pass without Manchin's support in the Senate, where Democrats have a razor-thin majority. Arizona Democratic Senator Kyrsten Sinema has also said she wants a smaller package. New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez tweeted in response, quote, Manchin has weekly huddles with Exxon and is one of many senators who gives lobbyists their pen to write so-called bipartisan fossil fuel bills. It's killing people, our people, at least 12 last night, sick of this bipartisan corruption that masquerades as clear-eyed moderation, Ocasio-Cortez tweeted. The Environmental Protection Agency warns in a new report the climate crisis will impact communities of color the hardest. The EPA found Black Americans are 40% more likely to live in areas where extreme temperatures will drive up deaths, especially if the world warms by 2 degrees Celsius. On Thursday, President Biden said Hurricane Ida and western wildfires were yet another reminder that the climate crisis has arrived. But during the same speech, Biden said his Energy Department is authorizing the release of 1.5 million barrels from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve to combat fuel shortages in Louisiana following Hurricane Ida.
That's why we're not waiting to assess the full impact of the storm is going to have on oil production and refineries. We're moving already, quickly, to increase the availability of gas and easing the pressure on gas prices around the country.
President Biden's traveling to Louisiana today to tour damage from Hurricane Ida. A federal judge has ruled against the U.S. government's practice of blocking asylum seekers from applying for refuge at the U.S.-Mexico border. The policy, known as metering, was first enforced by the Obama administration. It caps the number of people who can seek asylum at ports of entry and cross into the U.S. while their claims make it through the courts. President Trump later expanded metering across the southern border, forcing thousands of asylum seekers who were placed on long waiting lists to remain in Mexican border cities for months, where they face the threat of kidnapping, sexual assault, and murder. Lawyer Stephen Medlock, who argued the case on behalf of asylum seekers, said in a statement, quote, "The very government officials that should have been welcoming and assisting victims of persecution and torture were told to turn them away from the United States. The district court found that to be unequivocally illegal," Medlock said. In Georgia, a former district attorney has been indicted on misconduct charges for her role in interfering in the murder investigation of Ahmaud Arbery, the 25-year-old black man who was chased down and shot to death while out for a jog last year. A grand jury is accusing former prosecutor Jackie Johnson of covering up for the three white men involved in Arbery's killing and shielding them from criminal charges. Johnson had previously worked with one of the men, Greg McMichael, who's a former police officer. Johnson asked police officers not to arrest McMichael's son, Travis. The father and son, as well as their friend William Bryan, are facing numerous charges in Georgia, including felony murder. In the occupied Gaza Strip, Israeli soldiers killed a Palestinian man during a protest Thursday at the separation barrier. At least 15 others were wounded, including a child. Gazans have been holding nightly demonstrations against the Israeli blockade and the ongoing violation of their human rights. And in El Salvador, hundreds of people took to the streets of the capital, San Salvador, earlier this week, protesting the adoption of Bitcoin as an official currency, making El Salvador the first nation in the world to do so. The law, spearheaded by President Nayib Bukele, takes effect next week. Critics warn of drastic fluctuations in cryptocurrency's value and say Bitcoin is often used for money laundering. Opponents also worry about the economic impacts on poorer communities, many of which don't have access to bank accounts or smartphones. This is a Salvadoran union leader.
The technology implemented for the use of this coin is still very expensive for Salvadorians, especially our older adults. It's high-end technology that's needed to handle this virtual currency.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The death toll from the remnants of Hurricane Ida that led to flash floods and tornadoes in the northeastern United States has now topped 46. In a speech Thursday, President Biden addressed the natural disasters across the United States.
The people of Louisiana and Mississippi are resilient and resourceful. We're going to stand with you for as long as it takes to recover and allow you to rebuild. And to the country, the past few days of Hurricane Ida and the wildfires in the West and the unprecedented flash floods in New York and New Jersey is yet another reminder that these extreme storms and the climate crisis are here. We need to be much better prepared. We need to act.
This comes as a new report from the Environmental Protection Agency details how people of color in the United States will bear the brunt of the climate crisis. Nearly a million homes and businesses in Louisiana and Mississippi are without power after Hurricane Ida made landfall Sunday. Nearly a week later, most of the city of New Orleans remains in the dark. Reports are coming in of tragic scenes, including in Independence, Louisiana, where four nursing home residents died and nearly 800 more were rescued from a warehouse after they were taken there to ride out the storm from seven nursing homes, all owned by the same Baton Rouge businessman. They spent 6 days there, and several officials describe the elderly living in inhumane conditions, some calling out for medicine, others stuck in diapers full of feces. Meanwhile, the city of New Orleans remains under a curfew imposed Tuesday by the mayor and New Orleans Police Chief Sean Ferguson, who spoke Tuesday.
Effective today, 8 p.m. tonight, we will be enforcing our curfew ordinance, meaning that we're expecting everyone to comply. We also continue to enforce our anti-looting deployment, the added capacity in which the mayor mentioned. Lang, Louisiana National Guard. LSP will be in here with us as well. Our Orleans Parish Criminal Sheriff's Office has also assisted with this deployment. So we have more additional capacity to address the needs of our city.
For more, we go to New Orleans, to the neighborhood of Algiers, to speak by phone with Malik Rahim. We spoke to him extensively during Hurricane Katrina. You know that Ida hit on the 16th anniversary of Katrina. We spoke to him during Katrina, its aftermath, when he co-founded the Common Ground Collective, which helped bring thousands of people from all over the world to assist in the rebuilding of the city. He's also one of the founders of the Louisiana chapter of the Black Panther Party. In 2008, he was a congressional candidate for the Green Party. Malik, welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. I spent a lot of time with you walking through Algiers. Now you are there, continuing to help people. But talk about who isn't there and just the condition of where you are right now.
Well, first of all, Amy, I'm honored once again to be able to do an interview with you. I'm in Algiers. Can you hear me?
We hear you perfectly. And I want to tell our audience, we didn't want to bring Malik on Skype or use anything that would require more energy because of the complete power outage in New Orleans. So thank you, Malik, for joining us by phone.
All right. But again, it's an honor to be on your show. But before I go any further, first I got to give praise to my Lord and Savior, Christ Jesus, and to the God of Abraham. From there, Amy, I'm going to tell you, if this is deja vu, if this is truly deja vu, and by that man, it's happening again. Same day. Then that means in less than a month, we have another hurricane coming here. This is not nothing new. This happened in Lake Charles. It was hit by two Category 5 hurricanes in a little over a month. So if this is deja vu, then we need to start getting prepared for that. Now, as for what is lacking, what is lacking is the understanding that, once again, the poor was left. You know, those who had wealth, they left. Those who had any kind of income, when this hurricane, when Ida came this way, they left. They locked their second and third car up in the yard and their driveway, and they left. They didn't know or worry about giving the food away that they know was going to go bad. They just left. That's the reason why, once again, people start looting. Because once again, this hurricane happened when it was the worst time in America to be poor, after spending everything you had on school supplies. Now you're stuck. Now you're stuck in a city that have a heat index of 105. And the thing that really got to me that was lacking up until yesterday was ice. Because if you didn't have any money because you were broke and you was waiting on a first, you couldn't even go and buy a bag of ice. And if you bought one, walking in this heat back to your home, you lost at least a third of it. So you have people like this. Then the frustration came when the first came, when they had money in their account, but they can't access it. So that brings about it. But there's a saying, and I love what President Biden said, because he has the experience. He has witnessed what happened during Katrina. He was in government there. He was vice president when other national disasters happened. So, and by that, I mean, he have the experience. And the experience said when he said we need to get prepared. But it can't be no just one-sided preparation. In the aftermath of Katrina, we served over 500,000 people. This has been acknowledged by groups all over the world, with the exception of the city of New Orleans. I mean, the International Coalition of Sites of Conscience have designated not me, but my house as an international site of conscience, recognizing over 65 nations, but not in the city of New Orleans. You know, so again, you know, we have, because the thing that is needed is emergency disaster teams made up of people of their community. They could work in conjunction, especially with the fire department, and make sure that their community is taken care of. And if this was going on, then we'd be better prepared. If we be hit with another reader, it wouldn't catch us in the same dismal situation where we have to force people to go to the shelters. We could prepare for it. And the thing that is needed that's happening now, Amy, is the fact that now we have this going on. This going on right now. And look at where the need is. You know what I mean? This is going on. We're doing a pandemic. Nobody is talking right now about what's going to be the next impact that we're going to get hit with all these roofs that is leaking. Well, the only person that can afford to get their roof repaired is the rich. And the only person right now is able to afford to get somebody to put a tarp on their roof is those with some kind of money.
Malik, on Tuesday, New Orleans Mayor LaToya Cantrell imposed a citywide curfew for all the residents from 8 p.m. to 6 in the morning. The police chief said that the Louisiana State Police and National Guard are supplementing police patrols. Have you seen these troops? Have you seen the National Guard? How are they being used?
Well, I'm going to tell you one thing. Right now, what I've seen more of a, at least until he enforced this anti-looting law, bill, that we was working together like we didn't work during Katrina. They was paying people the type of respect. But, Amy, you know, I mean, it's heartbreaking when you see a woman with three kids in a house with no air conditioner, no fan, with nothing, you know, not even ice. When you see people that is fearful of taking their medication because they feel that it's going bad because, there again, there's no ice. But the thing that we have to look at is the next wave that's about to hit this city, and that is mold infestation. Because every house that got water in it gonna suffer with mold infestation. Are we prepared for it? Will you have people that's taking bleach and bleaching out their walls and killing themselves in the act trying to rid their homes of mold? Because that's the next thing that's going to happen. Mold abatement got to be right there on top of it. And then the next thing is the Gulf Coast, our wetlands. our wetlands was hit. Port Fourchon, Galliano, Cocotree. I could go on the Grand Isle. These people took the brunt of this. But they also sit in the right there in the petroleum industry. We have we have thousands of abandoned oil rigs in the Gulf of Mexico. We have thousands of them. What have been the impact of them? We need groups like Greenpeace to come down here and step up. And not just for agitation or for anything, but how can we work together? How can we work together with companies that have the reputation of working during these type of crises?
Malik,
next year
President Biden is coming to New Orleans today. What message do you have for him?
No, well, he came yesterday. I thought he came yesterday. But if he's coming today, only thing I'm not one of the privileged few that would be able to see him. But my message to him would be is to work with the community. The community is, a strong community. Don't need nobody to lead them. They know what to do. Work with the faith-based institutions here. Amy, right now in Algiers, we got 3 movie studios that have produced movies for over the last 10 years, have made billions of dollars. None of them have contributed nothing to this community other than making it now unaffordable for you to even rent. That's the reason why the crisis in New Orleans is so bad. People here can't rent in New Orleans. They can't afford it, not the working poor. They're already making half of what the average white family here making. And now they can't afford it. Every time there's a lot that's empty, you see a house, a big, beautiful home built in there. But nobody's helping the poor families and trying to keep them. Amy, listen, for over 12 years, I've been living in this house without water. I haven't done no repairs. My garage is just about done fell down. The need is and I'm going to tell you, if something that isn't happening, don't happen, because we are reorganizing Common Ground with the assistance of mutual aid and other former Common Grounders. Maybe they cannot come down, but they know what is needed to help us. We're looking for Tyvek suits. We're looking for respirators. We're looking for gloves and boots that can be used so that we could show people when they have to gut out their houses how to correctly do it and how to do the mold remediation. But then at the same time, we got to look at that Gulf. As you, I heard you mention about that Earl Spill. We got to understand this. That's why next year, during Katrina, we're going to have deja vu again, because I'm calling for a house, an environmental conference to be held here in New Orleans, where we can come together and talk about making sure that the safeguards is in place to assure that Gulf is kept as clean as possible.
Well, Malik, we're going to come back to touch base with you. I want to thank you so much for spending this time and the electricity you have in your phone. Malik Rahim in the Algiers neighborhood of New Orleans with a powerful message for the world. We first met him during Hurricane Katrina and its aftermath when he co-founded the Common Ground Collective, which helped bring thousands of people from around the world to help rebuild New Orleans and the surrounding areas. He's also one of the founders of the Louisiana chapter of the Black Panther Party, was a congressional candidate for the Green Party. Be safe. And again, we will talk to you soon. Next up, ahead of this Labor Day weekend, we look at dirty work, essential jobs, and the hidden toll of inequality in America with New Yorker writer A.O. Press and the people he profiles, like a former drone operator and the family member of a meatpacking worker. Stay with us.
Come all of you good workers, good news to you I'll tell of how the good old Union has come in here to dwell.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
My daddy was a miner and I'm a miner's son, and I'll stick with the Union till every battle's won.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
They say in Harlan County there are no neutrals there. You'll either be a Union man or a thug for J.H. Blair.
Which side are you on? Performed by Pete Seeger. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. This Monday is Labor Day. Today, we spend the rest of the hour looking at dirty work, essential jobs, and the hidden toll of inequality in America. It's the title of a new book by New Yorker writer A.O. Press. He profiles workers like prison guards and oil workers, and two people we'll speak to in a minute— a drone operator and the daughter of poultry plant workers. We begin with A.O. Press, who also has a new opinion piece in the New York Times headlined, America Runs on Dirty Work and Moral Inequality. A.O. is joining us from Buffalo, New York. A.O., welcome back to Democracy Now! You begin your book, A.O., with a quote from the great writer James Baldwin, who said, the powerless must do their own dirty work, the powerful have it done for them. Talk about what that means and what you mean by dirty work.
So I don't mean the common colloquial expression, which I think leads people to just think of, say, garbage truck workers who do something that's physically dirty. Dirty work in my book means unethical activity that society depends on and tacitly condones, but doesn't want to hear too much. So it is work that's sort of in the shadows. If we think of the work of conducting targeted assassinations in the drone program, or the work of running the mental health wards in America's jails and prisons, which, by the way, are the largest mental health institutions in this country, or the work of manning the kill floors in industrial slaughterhouses, all of those things, I argue in the book, are pretty essential to our existing social order, to the American way of life. You really can't imagine fast food, the American industrial food system, without the slaughterhouses I write about. You can't imagine the never-ending wars without the drone program. But we very rarely hear from this work is largely hidden, and we rarely hear from the people on the front lines who are delegated to do it. And to go back to the Baldwin quote, the book is about inequality, because the powerful and the privileged really don't do the dirty work in America. They not only don't do it, they don't see it. And so I'm particularly honored to be on this show because you've invited some of the people I've written about to tell their stories. We don't hear those stories enough, and also the family members of people who do this work.
So let's go to one of the workers in your new book, Dirty Work, Essential Jobs and the Hidden Toll of Inequality in America. Christopher Aaron, a former intelligence analyst for the CIA's drone program, a 2018 article that described his job opened like this, quote, in the spring of 2006, Christopher Aaron started working 12-hour shifts in a windowless room at the Counterterrorism Airborne Analysis Center in Langley, Virginia. He sat before a wall of flat-screen monitors that beamed live classified video feeds from drones hovering in distant war zones. Christopher Aaron joins us now from Tucson, Arizona. Christopher, welcome to Democracy Now! Describe the work you were doing in this faraway windowless room. Well, I mean by that far away from your targets in Afghanistan.
Yes, first of all, Amy, thank you so much for having me on the show today. If I could just take one moment, I've done this personally in the past, but I would like to take a moment now that the war is officially over to offer an apology to the people of Afghanistan from not only myself, but from the rest of our society as Americans. I think there needs to be somewhere in this dialogue a place for the human emotion of what we have all been through. And my words are wholly insufficient to do that. But if anyone is listening on the other side of the planet, we all apologize for what we have just done. My work was as an intelligence analyst. We were, you know, as the article says, we were behind video screens. There's a lot that was classified that I can't get into. I began my career, you know, working for another intelligence agency and then transferred over to this fusion cell at the CIA headquarters. This was my career out of college, you know, as a product of the 9/11 generation. And I wanted to do something for my generation that I saw that mattered, where I could do some good to try to help the world. We were behind the screens for 12 hours, you know, 3 to 4 days a week on rotating shifts, all hours of the night and day. After a few months, I had the opportunity to go to Afghanistan, and I served 2 6-month deployments, one in 2006 and then one again 2008 to 2009. And so I was able to see with my own eyes both the human toll, the resource toll of these wars, as well as the fact that the policy of dropping quote-unquote guided missiles at people from remote-controlled airplanes was not allowing us to actually win the war. So all three of those sides of things were failing, in my view.
Chris, you know, as the U.S. was pulling out of Afghanistan, and they talk about over-the-horizon capability, precisely what you're talking about, that the troops may not be there on the ground, but drone strikes. Well, in the last days of the U.S. presence in Kabul, that drone strike that killed a family of 10, 7 of them children, some under 5. Your feelings as you watch that unfold?
It's just horrific to see this happening as we are withdrawing. You know, I don't want to say this was commonplace throughout my time in the wars, but it certainly happened. You know, for every kill that we had of a quote-unquote extremist or terrorist, it's impossible to say, but there were certainly innocent casualties the entire time. We would often see in the streets the next day, we would be going after one person with a targeted strike, and the next day we would see 2 or 3 coffins being carried through the streets. And there was just this attitude at the time amongst the military or in the intelligence community, like, well, you know, this is the cost of war. This is what we have to do to get the terrorists, the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, etc. But you really start to put the pieces together and look at the cause and effect. And for example, with this drone strike just last week, it's not only the humans that were killed, but it's what about all their brothers? What about their sisters? What about their classmates in school? So whereas maybe you did successfully kill one extremist or one terrorist, you now have 5, 10, 15, 30 new ones to take their place. It's a failing policy. It's as simple as that.
And as the war comes to this chapter of this forever war comes to an end, how representative are you in speaking to your colleagues, the other people who are in that room, if you still do, other soldiers? And the corporate media, they have vet after soldier saying, if we're pulling out now, what did we do this for? Questioning the pullout. But not so much just the critical point of that question. What did we do this for?
It's a wonderful question. I began to ask myself that in 2006, and certainly after coming back again in 2008 to 2009, I saw with my own eyes that not only, of course, the wasted resources, the human toll on both sides of the fence, including the soldiers who I worked with who suffered tremendously from PTSD, which is something that I'm passionate about as well, but the loss of areas of control of the country in 2008-2009, the entire region in southern Afghanistan of Kandahar. This might sound kind of silly, but I had Thanksgiving dinner there in 2006 as we were flying into some of the remote bases. And by 2009, we could not return there. So I was like, wait a minute, you know, we're continuing this war. This was in 2009. We can't go back to a base that we formerly controlled. Why were we there the entire time? You know, there are others. I'm not the only one who has spoken out about this. There's Brandon Bryant, Sean Westmoreland, Lisa Ling, and of course, Daniel Hale, who has just been imprisoned just a month or two ago. However, I would say
it's few and far between the people.
Correct. Correct. And there were one or two, you know, pieces in there which were classified. It's something that I'm very careful about. However, you know, that's what they got him for under the Espionage Act. Ultimately, what were we there for? I am unable to accept that, you know, me as a 29-year-old back in 2009, that something that was so obvious to me about the failing of the trajectory of the wars, I'm unable to believe that my military superiors and the politicians way above me were not able to see the same thing. And so when faced with those sets of facts, a thinking person has to say, was there not perhaps a policy in play to keep us in a state of war for one reason or another?
Do you think that PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, that the questioning of why you were doing this, I mean, the apology you made at the beginning of this conversation, contributes to the horror you experience afterwards?
It does. I know, for me. And not only for me, for a lot of other people who I'm in touch with through veterans retreats. And to be fully upfront, again, to state it for the record, I am not technically a veteran. I was a DOD civilian. So it's a question of where your paycheck comes from. DOD civilian with a gun in a war zone, you know, working on the drone program. But anyway, I am in touch with a number of people who are also who have suffered in this way. And it's a different kind of PTSD. There's no way that I can compare what I went through to some of the people who saw their, you know, their brothers in the military blown up in front of them, or who themselves lost limbs or senses. I'm not trying to compare what we experienced to that. But at the same time, there's something that we experienced in people who volunteered for this program because we love this country. We love things that this country stands for as far as the freedoms that we have here. And then when you're faced with the reality on the ground through the video screen, that what is actually happening on the ground is not what is being reported in the mainstream media and is not what the higher ups in the military structure are telling us is going to win the war, you start to feel an immense sense of regret. And that's, you know, what I spoke with Eyal about extensively, you know, leading up to the New York Times article, is this what they call, you know, moral injury or moral regret. And it's for real.
Al, if you could talk about why you decided to include Chris, a drone operator for the CIA, in your profiling of essential workers. In your book, you say the truth is the drone program doesn't just serve the interests of military contractors. Talk about who it serves.
Well, I think that it's so appropriate that Chris began with that moving apology, and he made it collective. He wasn't just saying he's sorry, but that he's part of a society that has chosen to fight wars this way. And that's why I focused on him and other people in the drone program. You know, after Iraq and Afghanistan, the ground invasions, America was exhausted by those wars, disillusioned, and didn't like the cost, the price tag, both in terms of casualties and resources. And so what happened? Well, under Obama first, and then again under Trump, drones fighting from a distance without any physical risk, at least, to our side, and taking these war, keeping the same right to you know, target and kill people, even in countries with which we're not formally at war, but doing it in the shadows, doing it out of sight, out of mind. And the fundamental theme of my book is that those acts are not just the military's, and they are not just Chris Ahrens, and they are not just the current people in the drone programs. They're ours. We own what the impact of that is, what the legal repercussions and the moral repercussions. And I just am struck that, you know, in the beginning of the drone program, there was so much talk about this being antiseptic and it would be like playing a video game. But then as I researched it and also looked at what the military itself has found, you have huge rates of burnout in the program, analysts and imagery analysts and drone operators who quit or who just are mentally and emotionally and psychically distressed. Why? It's not because they evaded roadside bombs in the kind of the sense of injuries and PTSD that soldiers on the ground have had. It's because they're seeing intimately, day after day, shift after shift, violence unfolding on screens from a distance for which, in some cases, they feel responsible for things that go wrong, for things that for a strike that happens and they're not sure who was hit. And so this term moral injury kept coming up, not just in what I was reading, but when I actually visited some bases and talked to psychiatrists on those bases. And I think that moral injury, again, is doesn't belong just to the people who experience it, who are seeing what is done, but it belongs to all of us, to the society that has decided this is one of the ways we will continue fighting our wars.
Finally, very quickly, Chris, were you what many called a joystick warrior? And were these so-called joystick warriors, drone operators, treated differently than soldiers in the battlefield?
I was not a joystick operator. We communicated with them directly. There's a whole series of intelligence sources that come together to ultimately decide whether or not a strike will happen, a missile will be launched from the drone, or soldiers will go in. So where I fit in that chain was as an intelligence analyst, we essentially were providing the raw assessment as to what was happening on the ground. Are there people, so let's say we have the target who would be, let's say, the extremist inside a building that we're watching from the drone. And then the military commanders would come to us and say, are there women or children in that building as well? And based on the answers that we would give to them, sometimes a minute later, we would see a bright flash on the screen, and you're then counting how many dead bodies, in fact, do you see, you know, after that strike. So I was not the joystick operator myself, but, you know, that information is basically driving what the joystick operator does.
Well, I want to thank you, Christopher Ahren, for joining us, former intelligence analyst for CIA's drone program. AL Press, please stay with us, author of Dirty Work, Essential Jobs, and the Hidden Toll of Inequality in America. We're also going to link to that piece you wrote in the New York Times. And we're going to speak after break to another person profiled in Dirty Work, Dulce Castaneda, the children of Smithfield, led by family members of meatpacking workers. Stay with us. Between Your Teeth by McCarthy. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Monday is Labor Day. We're spending today's show with New York writer A.O. Press and some of the people he profiles in his new book, Dirty Work, Essential Jobs and the Hidden Toll of Inequality in America. This Labor Day comes amidst a new surge of coronavirus cases. The virus has been deadly for so many so-called essential workers, who are often low-wage workers, immigrants and people of color. Meatpacking plants have been deadly COVID-19 hotspots. These workers and their families are profiled in a section of the book called On the Kill Floors. For more, we go to Crete, Nebraska, to speak with Dulce Castaneda, founding member of Children of Smithfield, a Nebraska-based grassroots advocacy group led by the children and family members of meatpacking workers. Still with us, A.O. Press. Dulce, welcome to Democracy Now! Can you update us on what has been the situation at meatpacking plants and how immigrant essential workers have been impacted by the pandemic? And talk about your own family.
Absolutely. Thank you, Amy, for having me this morning. So to start out, I guess I'll say in April of last year, of 2020, we were entering a crisis worldwide. And it was a situation in Crete, Nebraska, where we were beginning to see, a lot of our public locations beginning to close down. Schools had shut down. Government buildings are beginning to close. And while all of this was happening, things at the Crete Smithfield plant sort of seemed to be remaining as usual. Nothing was really changing. And so my father, who's a meatpacking worker and works at the plant, I was hearing from him and from other community members sort of the working conditions that they were facing. They really weren't being provided any kind of COVID-19 protections. So they were being given hairnets to wear on their faces instead of face masks. And instead of, proper social distancing or sanitizing stations, what they were being, given was instead chips or cookies at lunch to thank them for their work. And so it was a situation where they weren't receiving the protections that they needed. And so, often these workers don't have the means to advocate or the time. And so, I, as my father's daughter and many of my colleagues who are like me, were worried about the health and safety of their parents, decided to form together and speak up and speak out about the conditions that they were facing. And so that's how I got involved in this work.
So talk about Nebraska. You're with Children of Smithfield, the meatpacking plant. In Nebraska, almost 7,000 COVID-19 cases were traced back to meatpacking plants, where, according to the Migration Policy Institute, 11% of the workforce is made up of undocumented people. Can you talk about the conditions in the plant that your father, that so many people faced? I mean, during the Trump years, you had Republican governor after governor standing with Trump, saying they would not let the meatpacking plants close, even as we heard of the number of people sick and dying. Do you know what that number is?
Unfortunately, in Nebraska, our governor decided to stop allowing health departments to release that information. So that information stopped being public in May of 2020, very early on. So, you know, at a time where we were seeing around more than 100 cases were already reported at the Crete Smithfield plant. And that number after that, you know, there was a number that we can no longer trace back. And so we had aggregate data at the state level from the Department of Health and Human Services, but there was nothing traceable back to certain locations or certain facilities. And so, you know, you would start to hear about people becoming sick or dying from word of mouth. You know, all of a sudden, this person was missing on the line. And you didn't know why. You could make assumptions, but you know, people began to stop showing up for work for one reason or another.
How easily were you, were family members, were family, were the workers themselves able to get vaccines?
Yeah, so they started vaccinating out at the plant in this year, I believe in March or April. So my father was fortunate enough to be able to be vaccinated out at the plant. And I know that they recently restarted vaccinating or having those available out at the facility within this last month.
And just for people to understand, what's produced at Smithfield, where your dad works, and what message do you have for this country as we move into Labor Day?
Sure. It's a pork processing facility. My father's worked there for more than 25 years now, and he's proud of the work that he does. He's always enjoyed his work, and he's a very hard worker. But I would say, you know, these are the forgotten jobs, folks who we forget that they're the backbone of our local economies and our national economy. So I would say, you know, if we really are thankful for the work that essential workers have done, especially in sustaining our societies and in such a moment of crisis, what better way to thank them than to start thinking critically about the access to different resources that they have or that they don't have, and how do we make sure that that they can access them in the future?
And finally, AL Press, who put together this wonderful, enlightening, painful book, Dirty Work, Essential Jobs, and the Hidden Toll of Inequality in America. What surprised you most in your research? You have 20 seconds.
Well, I think that just the incredible dignity of the people I wrote about, including Dulce and Chris, it is a dark book and it is a hard book to read. But I think it's so important as we approach Labor Day, but also beyond it, to hear their voices, to know that this work is connected to all of us. We shape the conditions it takes place under. We shape the harm it causes. And so we have to think about that and own it.
AL Press, author of Dirty Work, Essential Jobs, and the Hidden Toll of Inequality in America, and Dulce Castañeda with Children of Smithfield, speaking to us from Nebraska. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Berkley, Nick Oster, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warnoff, Tarina Nerdura, and Sam Alkoff. Special thanks to Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Pop Montreal International Music Festival is celebrating its 20th anniversary from September 22nd to 26th, 2021. 5 days of music, films, art, crafts, panels, and more, featuring Cakes Tequila, Backwash, The Besnard Lakes, The Deers, Handsome Eli, and more. Tickets on sale now at popmontreal.com.
So, Other than that, I mean, you know, what's going on? What are you saying?
Buenas tardes.
And we'll be back.
Missed your favorite show? Not a problem. Go to www.ckut.ca and follow the link to CKUT's easy-to-use archives. Instructions are on the page. 2 months' worth of archives are stored in mono and half a month's worth in stereo.
Pleasant good afternoon to you, Montreal.
If you're having trouble, please email sys@ckut.ca. That's sys@ckut.ca. Oh,
yeah! I want to be your motivator. Au préféré sur scène, il y a pensé toute la semaine. Il a acheté son billet, il a mis son chandail du groupe, il s'est rendu à la salle de spectacle. Il n'a pas pu rentrer dans la salle de spectacle. Il a rangé son chandail du groupe, il a acheté son billet et il y a pensé toute la semaine.
N'attendez pas de frapper un mur. Faites-vous vacciner. En septembre, le passeport vaccinal sera exigé pour fréquenter certains lieux publics. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
Your Made in Brazil show is starting now in your CKUT 90.3 FM radio in Montreal. The show is being recorded remotely from home. I'm your host and programmer. My name is Daniel Shore, and I am respecting the measures of social distancing in place in Montreal. I'll be with you for 2 hours on this special edition of Brazilian music to listen and enjoy during the quarantine. Thanks for listening.
Oi, meu nome é Henrique e a gente tá fazendo vídeo aqui, teste.
1, 2, 1, 2, 1.
Cada um no mundo, toda a terra intocada, que só seja infectada por um samba vagabundo. E só
por um segundo vou fazer minha serenata desse lado da janela.
Por alguns dias vou manter a batucada, também quando a gente serve.